Jill, myself, and Lucy have had the pleasure of spending the last few days with Ron and his beautiful daughter, Pam. I tell you, we don't have enough time to hear all of Ron's stories. So he's going to pick the best for you tonight. I reminded him to keep it family friendly. Because some of the stories are just us guys. And we talk like military men. And I first want to tell you a little bit about Ron's daughter. She too has served our country with the great, wonderful, fabulous 101st Airborne.
Ooh, yeah. Ooh!
And to add more glory to that, so has her daughter. Ooh! And to add more glory, so has her son-in-law's. Ooh! So that's all about Pam. Now let's talk about her father, Ron. He was born October the 24th, 1929 in Columbus, Ohio. Rosser was the second oldest of 17 children. You're either Catholic or Kentuckian, one or the other.
They're careless.
He joined the Army in 1946 at the age 17, shortly after World War II for a 3-year term of service. After his older brother was killed in the early stages of the Korean War, he re-enlisted from Crooksville, Ohio in 1951 as a way of getting revenge. Initially stationed in Japan, Rosser requested to be sent into the combat zone and was then deployed to Korea as a heavy mortar company of the 38th Infantry Regiment, 2nd Infantry Division. On January 12, 1952, Rosser, by then a corporal, was acting as a forward observer with Company L's lead platoon during an assault on a heavily fortified hill near Pongeli. Thank you. When the unit came under heavy fire, Rosser went forward 3 times and attacked the hostile positions alone, each time returning to friendly lines to gather more ammunition before charging the hill again. Although wounded himself, he helped carry injured soldiers to safety once withdrawal became necessary. When the report was received that he was recommended for the Medal of Honor, he was called off the lines, but he refused. His colonel personally called him to return, and he refused again. His colonel was notified by the commanding general to remove him immediately, or he could forget the Medal of Honor. Again, he refused to leave his men. The Chinese speared him and his carbine with a fixed bayonet that he carried. He fired that weapon and wielded it in close combat with deadly accuracy. Needless to say, it took an escort to remove him. Rosser returned to the United States back in May 1952 and was formally presented with the Medal of Honor by President Harry Truman a month later on June 27, 1952. In 1968, another of the Rosser brothers was killed in action, this time in the Vietnam War. Rosser requested a combat assignment in Vietnam, but was rejected and subsequently retired from the Army as a master sergeant. Rosser then received a second Medal of Honor from President, oh my goodness, that's not his name, it's just his name. Sigmund, say it for me, Ron. You can't either.
Not Sigmund Rhee.
Yeah, there we go. Of Korea for his heroic combat actions in Korea. Ross will be the Grand Marshal of the New York Day Rose Bowl Parade in 2019. Ladies and gentlemen, Ron Rosser, Medal of Honor. Now, are you going to kind of moderate a little bit with your dad and...
Well, I guess I'll let him take it over.
Okay. Ron, it's all yours.
Well, to start with, I'd like to correct something. I didn't go back to friendly lines. I went down about 20, 25 yards down the mountain where my dead and wounded was and got their ammunition and hit them again. I started out in July of 51 and as a Fort Observer and fought in around the Punch Bowl and a mountain we called 1179. And somebody wrote a book about it called The Battle Above the Clouds because we fought up the mountain through the clouds and then fought on top of the mountain. And from there I went into the what we called the Bloody Ridge on the Pearee Valley. And I served in very close combat there. While I was there, I was able to knock out a enemy armored person, armored personnel carrier, and a blistered paint on a T-34 tank there with artillery, and I knocked out the one and forced the other to retire. I was a Fort Observer, and my job when the Army attacked it, my company or regiment or whatever, my job was to go with the assault platoon, and I never failed to go with that. We finally took the Bloody Ridge after 6 weeks, and we went into the Mundanee Valley and made the assault on the Heartbreak Ridge. And it sounds like a little old ridge, you know, but this ridge was a mountain range about 7 miles long, and it had several divisions of enemy on it. When we finally took it, the Heartbreak, my whole division went into Corps Reserve because they were so under strength. We had lost so many people. All but my company. My company, Heavy Mortar Company, was moved in behind the Turks, and I went up as a Fort Observer with the Turks. And that made five different countries I'd fought with in combat. The American Army, the South Korean Army, the Dutch Army, the French Army, and the Turkish Army. My regiment was to relieve the Turkish Brigade when they got back to strength. And so I was with the Turks almost a month before we relieved them. Once the Americans took over, we started deep patrols. And I mean deep patrols, we'd go miles behind enemy lines. And just to give you an idea, the day before Christmas 1951, I went out with a reinforced platoon from my company of 73, counting me and my radio man. And we took on hundreds of Chinese, I mean absolutely hundreds, and we were being wiped out, and by that time the officers was gone and I was leading them, and we tried to cross the river to get across the river and go down the other side, and so we took our rifles and beat our way through the ice to get into the river, and we got almost across, and about 300 Chinese come down the other side, and we had to swim for it. And we're fighting the best we can, firing at them because they lined the banks, both sides. And they were throwing hand grenades at us and shooting at us with submachine guns. Five of us got out of the river alive, and I was the only one that wasn't wounded. I made other short patrols, and then I had to go down to headquarters for an interview for another big mission. And it was a reinforced rifle company. About 170 men, and we were going to take this whole mountain, and at that time we had at least a battalion of Chinese up there. Unknown to us, there was two other battalions in behind it, in which when we was going up one side, they was coming up the other. We put a group, a reinforced platoon to hit the front of the mountain, and pretty close to 40 men, and eight of them lived, and they were all wounded. my group went around to near the back of the mountain and stormed up the mountain, fighting through the trenches and into bunkers loaded with Chinese. And when we got within about 40 yards of the top of the mountain, there was about 35 of us left, counting the walking wounded, and I had the only radio left with the outside world. So I called my regimental commander, and I gave him a situation report, about out of ammunition, down to 35 effectives. And I was a corporal, and he didn't want to talk to me. He wanted to talk to a commissioned officer, and we still had two alive, and both of them badly wounded. And so I drug the radio up to the company commander, and he was hit in the face, and his whole face was cut in two, and it was 25 below zero, and his face was frozen blood. And I told him the colonel wanted to talk to him, so he started talking to the colonel, and the colonel told him to reorganize his men and make one final attempt to take his objective. And the captain said, yes, sir. And he looked up the mountain, and he got this kind of a hopeless look on his face. Right in front of us was about a 200-man Chinese line carrying submachine guns and other stuff, heavy equipment, and five heavy machine guns. And the captain got this hopeless look on his face, and I heard somebody say, I'll take him up for you, Captain. And I realized it was me talking, and I tried to put my hand over my mouth. And so it shut up, but too late. And the captain said, how are you going to do it, Ron? And I said, there's only one way, Captain, that's straight in shooting. And he said, you know you're not going to make it, don't you? And I said, well, we'll give it a try, sir. So I got all these men that were still on their feet and lined them up. And I told him, I said, you're not going to have no trouble knowing which way to go, boys. Just follow me, because we're going in shooting. And I got them ready and jumped up, and I said, let's go. So I started moving fast up the mountain. And these kids were moving just a little bit slower than me. I think they were a little nervous. And they got caught in the crossfire. And when I got about 3 to 4 feet from the Chinese trench, and they were in the trench right in front of me, and I could hear them talking, and they were in the trench, and I'm on the other side of the dirt from that trench, and I looked back, and I was by myself. All the men was either killed, wounded, or dove for cover. And I remember thinking, well, Ron Rosser, you went to a lot of trouble to get here. No use wasting the whole day. And I let out a war whoop and jumped in the trench with them. And I landed between two Chinese. And as I hit the ground, I jammed my carbine into one of them's ear and blew off his other ear. And the one behind me there slammed a burp gun in my back, submachine gun in my back, and was pulling the trigger. And I could actually, in my mind, feel the bullets coming through me, but they didn't make it. And I spun around, I got him in the neck, and he dropped his burp gun and grabbed me by the leg. And I hit him with my rifle and knocked him off of me and shot him in the heart. Then I spun around and I charged straight into the big line of Chinese in the trench. And I went down the trench shooting them and beating on them. And I killed probably 15. And it was about 10 yards down from the very top of the mountain. And as soon as I cleared that, boy, I charged up and jumped in the trench above me and started to run down through there. And I shot some Chinese and got to a machine gun bunker. And some Chinese didn't want to be trapped in a bunker, and they was trying to come out. So I started shooting through the door of the bunker and chased them back in. Then I climbed up on top of the bunker, and I had one hand grenade, and it was a white phosphorus grenade. And I pulled his pin on it and kicked a spoon and held it a couple of seconds and reached down and rolled it in the door. And it set a whole bunch of them on fire. And a couple of them crawled out, and one of them, his whole face was burnt up. And my eyes gone, everything, and I just shot him in the head. If I shot the first one, the second one tried to crawl over him. I shot him too, and I got up on top of the bunker and was trying to get some of the guys to come up and help me. And every time they moved, somebody would kill him or wound him. And so I looked, and here come about 35 Chinese down another trench running into the one I was in, and they was after me hot and heavy, so I knew if I run, they'd get me. And so I charged them, and I don't think they was expecting that. And I was hollering like a wild man and shooting. And the first guy emptied the submachine gun into me, and the bullets was going through my clothes and everything, but not a bullet touched me. And when I got close, he panicked and tried to get around the guy behind him, and he dropped his burp gun doing it, and he's trying to crawl over that guy, and that guy couldn't shoot straight, and I was shooting into him, and all at once they all panicked and they all turned and started running away from me. And I started chasing them. I went a few steps and I just stopped and started shooting them in the back of the head, bam, 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 you know. And then they made another turn in the trench, and I jumped out and cut across, and as they run by me, I shot a few more as they run by me. And I finally run out of ammunition, and I went back to where I started, and some kid broke through to me, and he was shot instantly. Some guy tried to shoot us both and got him, and I had an empty rifle, but that Chinaman didn't know it, and I swung my carbine around on him, and I think it made him nervous, and he turned and run, because I'm bluffing. You gotta have nothing. And I picked this kid up and started walking down the mountain with him about 30 yards to get him under the lip of the hill where he couldn't get direct fire. And the Chinese was running down behind me trying to bayonet me and shoot me, but there wasn't nothing I could do about it, so I just kept on walking. And the wounded men laying in the snow down there, they started knocking these Chinese down around me. And for the first time in my life, in a serious place, I started laughing. I thought it was funny, all these people trying to get down there and bayonet me and shoot me, and they're getting is killed. And I went walking down the hill laughing, and the other officer was still alive, was a young artillery port observer, and he'd lost all his people and was shot in the chest, and he had an M1 rifle, and he was back to being a rifleman. And he stepped out and he asked me what my name was, and I told him. And he said, "Do you know what you're doing there, soldier?" And I said, "Yes, I'm killing these varmints as fast as I can, but I'm out of ammunition. I got to get me some damn ammo." And he said, "I'm going to shake your hands." And in the whole Korean War, I never done nothing more sillier than that, standing in the middle of a firefight, shaking hands with a lieutenant. And so I took this kid down undercover, and then I started crawling around my dead and wounded and got a bunch of hand grenades. And I had 13 or 14 hand grenades in my pocket and hanging on my uniform everywhere, and some magazines for my carbine. I just slung it on my shoulder and took two hand grenades and pulled the pins on them and held the spoons down and started dog dropping by myself up toward the Chinese. There was a big line of them up there. And they kind of looked at me for a minute. I couldn't believe what they were seeing. One guy come and charged them. And they all at once they opened up on me. When they did, I threw my first hand grenade as hard as I could throw it toward them. And instead of keep shooting me, they all raised up to see where the grenade was going and went right into the trench with them. And kind of opened up a hole there. And as I went through, almost got to them, I kicked a spoon on the second one and flipped it in the trench with the rest of the Chinese, some more Chinese. And then I got in behind them. And the first time when I was up there, I had engaged about 75 Chinese. And this time, about 200 of them was piling on me. And I'm charging straight into them, shooting and making them duck, you know. And then I'd jump over top of them and shoot a couple of them and turn around and charge them before they could turn around to get me again. And some darn Chinaman threw a hand grenade. I'd already been hit in the hand. And a Chinaman threw the hand grenade and got me through the shoulder. And that was the fourth, it went all the way through, and that was the fourth time I was wounded. And I would tell you, folks, that made me mad. I got tired of them people doing that to me. And I took after that varmint, and he was running like hell across the top of the mountain, and me chasing him, and he ran right through about 20 Chinese, and I just followed him through, and I shot a couple of them on the way through, and kind of opened the door up. And I finally got close enough and shot him, and he was laying there squirming, so I shot him again. And I turned around and started charging into the Chinese, and a darn Chinaman come from, I don't know where he come from, he jumped on my back and had me around the neck, and another tackled me and had me by the leg, and another jumped up and started beating me with a rifle. And I'm trying to swing around to shoot him, and about a dozen more piled on me trying to capture me. My regimental commander was watching, you know, with these people piling on me. He was watching me through binoculars, and they just down I went. And But on the way down, I emptied a 30-round magazine into them and kind of took the starch out of them. And when I hit ground, my knee hit the ground, I had a little room, and I kicked my mag out and slapped a new one in and just started spraying above me. And all at once, a hole opened up, and my regimental commander thought I was dead, you know, because they put all these people put me down. And they all at once, he seen my head popping up, and he said, "My God, he's alive." And there were still five of them Chinese still, you know, they're wounded but not dead. So I shot them in the head. I always figured it was on a long journey, and I was paying their fare. A dead man can't hurt you. See, I'm a product of Fort Benning, Georgia, the infantry school. And the motto of the infantry is to close with the enemy and kill him. Don't worry about giving him a drink of water or a cigarette. If he wants a cigarette, shoot him anyhow. That's the way I was. In fact, my regimental commander used to give me heck for killing everybody, you know. I wanted prisoners to get information, but I'd shoot them anyhow. They even taught me some Chinese, and I always tell them I forget what to say. And after I broke loose on them, I went charging into a bunch more, and I knocked out two big bunkers in the middle of the hill, and it was full of Chinese. I don't know how many, and wasn't even interested. I chased a bunch of them in there and threw in some hand grenades. And I kept going until I ran out of ammunition again, both hand grenades and ammo, and went over and walked back down to to my dead and wounded, and I got some more hand grenades. I couldn't get any magazines for my carbine. Nobody had any. And I just, again, slung hand grenades all over me and pulled the pin on a couple of them and started dog-trotting up the hill again. And I got there and just went right over to the top of them, you know, right between the Chinese, and got in behind him and started throwing hand grenades in every direction. And the reason I was doing this, you know, it sounded like I was trying to be brave or anything, but I really wasn't. The Chinese were bunching up to sweep down and kill our wounded, and I'm the only one standing. And if I didn't stop them, nobody would. And after three times up on the mountain, top of the mountain, fighting the Chinese by myself, I drug five wounded men into a shell crater, and we got some ammunition, and we held off the Chinese, and we were about 20 yards from the top of the mountain, and they're throwing hand grenades and all kind of mess at us, charging us with big bunches. And we're holding them off while our walking wounded drug the dead and wounded down the mountain and loaded them on tanks and got them out. And some kid came up to us and said, "Ron, we got everybody we can find." And I turned to my other boys and I said, "Let's get the heck out of here." And we got up and started walking down the mountain, and the Chinese never fired another shot at us. And some generals asked me, he said, "Sergeant Rosser, why didn't the enemy keep shooting at you?" I said, "I think they was glad to see us go." and 3 days later, I got put in for the Medal of Honor, and my regimental commander, by regulation, ordered me off the line. I told him, "No, I'm not coming off." And he said, "Ron, I got to take you off." And I said, "Colonel, I'm not coming off." He said, "Ron, I'm required by regulation and everything to take you off. You got to come off." And I said, "Colonel, you need to go see the medics." And he said, "What for?" I said, "You're getting hard hearing." And so he didn't know what to do with me, you know. So he said, "I'll get back with you." And so my paperwork a few days later hit 8th Army, and this 2-star general called Colonel Ronnie up and asked him what he had done to keep me alive. And Colonel Ronnie said, "He's still on the line, sir. He won't come off." And the general said, "You're a colonel and he's a corporal and he won't obey you." He said, "No, he don't care. He won't leave his men." And the general said, "You go get Rosser today, and if you got to drag him off, bring him off." And so Colonel Ronnie called me again, and he said, "I got to come get you, Ron. I'm under orders." And I told me what the general said, and I said, "Will you do me a favor, sir?" And he said, "If I can." I said, "You tell that general two things. One, I'm not coming off the line, And two, if he bothers me anymore, he can take that medal and stick it where the sun don't shine. And the general thought I was crazy. Yeah, I probably was, really. I was good at what I did. When I went through the parachute school in 1946, the men from that jumped into Normandy and other places, they were my instructors that took me through the school. And they taught me two things. One, the fight don't start until you're surrounded, which the airborne, you jump behind the lines, which I didn't do. And two, don't be afraid, it don't help. And I always remembered that. Even in close hand-to-hand combat, I'd always be grinning or laughing. And when I got ready to leave Korea, my fire direction people who kept track of what I had done, and I didn't, I had no idea. It was just something that happened in the past, the day before and everything, and I didn't care what happened, just as long as I was alive to do it again. And he said, "Ron, do you have any idea how many people you've taken out?" And I said, "No, I don't, and I don't think I want to know." He said, "Well, I'm going to tell you anyhow." He said, "We got it on record. You've killed at least 10,000 North Koreans and Chinese." And I said, "You're kidding, you know." But there was 4 days I killed over 1,000 North Koreans and Chinese with mortar fire and artillery fire. I've shot to death somewhere between 400 and 500, and I don't know how many I got with hand grenades because there's no way of telling. And I hold the record in America for hand-to-hand combat. And I've actually killed 20 enemy soldiers in hand-to-hand combat. And here not too long ago, some four-star general said, asked me, said, "Sergeant Rosser, why were you involved in so much hand-to-hand combat?" I said, "Well, to start with, General, it wasn't my idea. Damn fools are piled in on top of me, you know."
"Hey, Dad, what about that tiger?"
"Sir?"
"That tiger."
"The tiger?"
"Yeah,
tell me." "Yeah, well, she reminded me there, one day I was kind of between our lines and the enemy lines, and I was going over this little knoll, or starting to go over this knoll, and a great big Asian tiger went over the knoll up ahead of me. And I thought, I'm going to shoot that varmint. And I ran down the hill a little bit and went up over it. And as soon as I got on top, I met him up there. The varmint had done, he went down and came up too. And he crouched down to charge me. And it just scared the living hell out of me, because about 10 days before, a tiger had jumped on a sergeant up in the 81 mortars and ripped his whole stomach and chest open. But the sergeant killed him. But they took the sergeant out with tore all to pieces. And I didn't like being tore all to pieces. So real quick, like, I lowered my carbine, and because the M2 carbine, I fired a burst. And I got him about 6 times in the side. Instead of charging me, he started spinning around, biting at his side, and then he took off. And I knocked him down 2 more times, and he was still going. And I made up my mind, I ain't going after no more tigers. Because they're bigger than the Indian tiger. A lot of things happened to me. In 1958, I was selected as one of the 19 men to be the body bearer of the unknown soldiers of World War II in Korea. And I'm an old top sergeant down the parachute school, and nobody tells me nothing. You know, I'm kind of a hard guy. And so we all went up there, and the colonel commanded the old guard there at Arlington National Cemetery. He called us into this room, and he said, "Boys," he said, we're gonna train all of you, and then we're gonna pick the 12 best to be the body bearers and send the rest of you back to your unit." And I put up my hand, and he said, "Yes, Sergeant Rosser." I said, "Sir, we appreciate that, but that's not the way it's gonna be." And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Sir, this is an important thing in our lives, and we're all going to be part of it." He said, "Sergeant Rosser, you do exactly as I tell you." And I said, "Well, we appreciate that, sir, but that ain't going to happen either." And he said, "Who put you in charge?" And I said, "The President of the United States, sir." I said, "If you want to, we'll go over to the White House and have a talk with him, and maybe he can help you out." And the old colonel didn't want to go talk to the presidency, and I was bluffing anyhow. So I became kind of in charge there. And there were some interesting people in that group. And the guy, I had World War II up until the final internment, then I moved over to the Korean body because I was to present the flag of the unknown soldier of the Korean War to the Vice President Richard Nixon. And it was a really interesting thing. All kind of things happened to me. Here, about 4.5 years ago, I was selected as one of the one of the judges at the Mrs. America contest. And they told me in front of a whole bunch of other Medal of Honors, and this one recipient, he was a bird colonel, and he said, "Ron," said, "why did they pick you instead of me?" He said, "I'm a colonel and you're a sergeant." He said, I got more education than you. I'm smarter than you. I'm better looking than you. Why would they pick you instead of me?" I said, "Well, they probably thought I knew more about women than you do." Well, I had an advantage over them. I'd been married 7 times. most of it my fault. I was a career service man, and they shipped me all over the world, and with very little notice. And when you come back, you know, you're strangers. You know, if you're gone 3 or 4 years, you're strangers. And I know some other people probably in this crowd had the same problem. And I've done all kind of things. I went to Korea in 1975, at the request of the Korean people. And the president of Korea, Park Chung-hee, had me up on the dais with the stage. And he was giving a speech to about 1,000 people, including the ambassador of every nation that served in United Nations in Korea. And he told him, he said, "Because of Sergeant Rosser and a handful of men like him," he said, 50 million people walk the face of this earth as free people. And that made me feel good. They'd been worthwhile. They're constantly doing stuff like that, you know, sending me off to things. One time I was down in Fort Benning and visiting, and this 2-star general brought the air marshal of the Soviet Union over to introduce him to me. And the air marshal was like a 5-star general. And the American general introduced me to the air marshal, and the air marshal put out his hand to shake hands. And you know, I had 2 brothers killed by the communists, and I'm not too darn friendly with them. And I looked at the air marshal and I said, "I'm going to tell you something, mister. I ain't shaking hands with no communist SOB." Only I said it a little plainer. And he got a funny look on his face and went like that. And then he started laughing and reached out and with his hand again, and I shook hands with him. I said, "What the heck?" And shook hands with him. And while I was shaking hands with him, he said, "Sergeant Rosser, I'd like to invite you to go to Moscow to lead a parade down through Moscow commemorating one of the great battles of the Second World War between the Germans and the Russians." And he said, "We will take care of you, everything." And the American general said, "Are you interested in doing that, Sergeant Rosser?" And I said, "Hell, General, I already got my bag packed." And I went over there, and I was involved in all kind of things. I went in and out of the Kremlin like I owned a darn place. And I was in there this one afternoon, and 2 high-ranking Russian officers escorted me through this large crowd into this big open room where everybody could stand there and look. And here was the mayor of Moscow. So we met, and I shook hands with him, and I reached in my pocket, and I pulled out this scroll. It was a proclamation from the governor of Ohio. I read the proclamation and then handed it to the mayor of Moscow. He said, "Mr. Rosser, your proclamation shall hang in a place of honor in the Kremlin." And heck, the whole thing was about me. So I guess I got a proclamation still hanging in the Kremlin. I did about everything. I went over and talked to a school that spoke nothing but English. They were the children of the leaders of Russia. And they talked to them, and their principal was about a 35-year-old good-looking woman. And I can tell you right now, folks, she could kiss as good as Americans can. I had a good time with her and with them kids. I've done things. I keep doing it all the time. I'm getting used to it. I've been a guest at the White House under every president since Franklin Roosevelt. Here last fall, I was at the Oval Office with President Trump, and he was sitting at his desk, and I was sitting up against his desk and in my wheelchair, and he said, "Sergeant Rosser," he said, "how's it feel to be in the Oval Office with the President of the United States?" I said, "Sir, I've been in this office under every president since Franklin Roosevelt." And he said, "You're kidding." I said, "No, sir, I'm not kidding." And he said, "They tell me you're the oldest recipient here." And I said, "Well, I've heard that." And he said, "Did you know any of the older guys?" And I said, "Sir, I ran around with the recipients of the Medal of Honor from the Spanish-American War, the Boxer Rebellion, the Philippine Insurrection, Vera Cruz, the punitive expedition against Pancho Villa, the Banana Wars, the World War I, World War II, and so forth. And even all the guys from Afghanistan, I know them." In 1959, I was sent to the 101st Airborne.
Oh!
Yeah. And while I was there, the Army sent me to Palmall, Tennessee to arrange the funeral of Alvin York. How many people here ever heard of Sergeant York?
Yeah.
There you go. Well, I went there and talked to that boy. Oh, and he was a very old gray-headed man, you know, laying in a hospital bed. And I talked to him about 3 hours, and for the first time, I felt like a high school kid around him. The only thing he wanted to do was show me all his guns he had. Lord, he had a mess of them. And he was really a nice old man. He didn't die for 3.5 years, but I had the people there build a great big concrete helicopter pad with a windsock, you know, so that our helicopters could bring in distinguished guests. And that's just some of the stuff I've done. And when I was an instructor at the parachute school down at Fort Benning, Georgia, I was assigned as the personal escort of King Saud of Saudi Arabia. He didn't impress me very much, but his bodyguard did. Every time he walked, he clanked. He had so many guns. And I've been doing that stuff almost all my life. I know everybody. I think I talked enough. Does anybody here have a question?
Where was you September 11th?
My daughter wanted to, September the 11th, a few years back there when they hit the towers in New York. I happened to be in Seoul, Korea there visiting the Korean people, and I couldn't come home. My time was up and I couldn't come home. And they stopped all incoming flights, so I grabbed me a flight and went to China at their invitation, of course. Walked the Great Wall of China and had a really good time over there. And they had a little banquet for me and some other folks. And I didn't know until I started eating there that, you know, the main course was a dog. And and they served me a bowl of noodles, and I got one out with on my old chopsticks and ate about half of it. And I looked and I said, "Noodles don't have rings on them." And I reached down and got a whole one out there, and it was night crawlers. Them farmers had got even with me for the Korean War. So, you know, life's been really interesting for me. It's really been a lot of fun. Anybody have a question? Yes, sir.
What was President Truman like?
A very, very great gentleman. The only problem he had there when he was about to present me the Medal of Honor, he said, "I'm presenting the Medal of Honor to Sergeant Crosser." And he looked again, he said, "Excuse me, ladies, gentlemen, that's Rosser." And so the President of the United States misspelled or mispronounced my name. But he was a nice guy. I've been with all of them, you know, most of the time, several times. When I was stationed down in West Palm Beach, Florida, President Kennedy flew down in Air Force One down to our air base there, and he had promised me when I was with him at the White House that he was going to take me a ride on his yacht to Honey Fitz. So I went over and met him there, and I was checking on that ride, and he said, "Sergeant Rosser, I'd like to do it, but," he said, "I'm here just for today." He said, "I stopped by to see my mother." He said, "I'm on my way to Dallas." So the next day they shot him. I've been with all of them, you know, and a lot of things happened. One of the most interesting thing, when I go to the inaugural ball, which I've been to every one since Harry Truman, no matter who gets elected, I go. I get invited, and they have a roast pig, you know, an apple in his mouth, and man, the best of everything. I mean, the best. Jimmy Carter got elected president, and I got and went to the inaugural ball and the banquet and everything, and I cut in there, and he had great big baskets full of peanuts, and sitting on the table, we had a big cheeses about that big around and about that high with plastic knives sticking in it, and you get all the peanuts you wanted and get as big a chunk of cheese as you wanted, and I can tell you I didn't enjoy the inaugural ball that day, and I didn't eat many peanuts and cheese. I get when the, a lot of times when the President of the United States presents a Medal of Honor to a living person down at the White House there, I get invited for the ceremony. And I get invited for a lot of different things. I fly out of Columbus, Ohio down to Washington, and the FBI picks me up at the airport and takes me to the hotel. I clean up and put on a suit or whatever, and Secret Service come and picks me up, and it's easier for me to get into the White House than it is to get through the airport in Columbus, Ohio. Yes, sir.
Hey, Master Sergeant, did Secret Service have a special call sign for you like they do the President?
Yes, sir. They wear a special badge, and I wear a special badge, too. Of course, I know all the guys that's with us. I've been with them for 20 years or better. You can go anywhere with that badge on. Nobody's going to bother you. They think you're Secret Service, because I wear a Secret Service badge too, but that's because they give me one, because I'm down there all the time. In fact, I was down there a week ago to the White House and with the President. My daughter and I was down and got our picture taken with him. Next month, I go back to Korea, and I have to speak to the Korean people and the Korean Army. And I come back from there, and I got to go to Dallas, Texas, for something. And in the third of November, how many people here has been to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington National Cemetery? Okay, that's great. Those people that walked the tomb have formed their own organization, like, you know, the VFW and all that, only the tomb guards. And so the 3rd of November, I'm to go down and speak to them, because I'm the last surviving body bearer of the unknown soldiers. Just about 3 or 4 years ago, people in Arlington asked me to come down, and they wanted to do a movie about what I knew about the burial. All the people that was involved in it, in the burial of the unknown soldiers of World War II in Korea, they all died. They was all dead, and nobody knew how they were selected. So I went down and explained how every one of those people were selected. Over in Europe, they took up about 30 unknown bodies, and, you know, put them out there on display, and with American flags on them. And then one of our people went up, walked through them all, and went up and picked one, and they took him out of the group and they reburied the rest. Same thing over in the Pacific. All the burial grounds over in the Pacific where they had unknowns, they dug up one from every place and took them to Hawaii and again put them up on display with American flags on them and everything. And one of our people went over and selected one. They reburied the rest. Then they got a bunch of Korean unknown. One of our people picked one of them, and then the World War II from the Pacific and the Korean was loaded onto a destroyer and headed for the Panama Canal. Over in Europe, they loaded this other kid on a destroyer, and he headed for the canal. And the one from Europe stopped on the east side of the canal. The other one came through, and then they loaded the World War II from Europe onto the other one. And they, one of our people, again, they went up and they started moving the bodies so nobody would know which was which, other than the Korean body was already marked because there's only one of them. And selected one of them, and they buried the other in the sea. Then they brought him up to the naval base there in Washington, and I picked a group there to go over and take him off the ship and bring him to the capital. And the World War II was placed on the catafalque that Abraham Lincoln laid on, and they had another right beside him for the Korean War. Then 24 hours later, we moved him, and then 24 hours later, we moved him back, and then we got him, loaded him aboard gun caissons from the Civil War, and took him to Arlington National Cemetery. And of that 19 that was selected for that duty, I'm the last one alive. And of course, I'm a young man compared to some of you people. I'm only 89.
They were all recipients.
Mm-hmm. But life gets interesting. Any more questions? Yes, sir.
Is General Patton in your family tree anywhere?
No. No. Patton was a very smart man, but the one thing I remember about him, he told some officer that he was going to beat that guy from England to Berlin if it took a dog or took a pickup truckload of dog tags. And after that, I didn't think too highly of him because I wore a pair of dog tags, you know, for 20 some years. He was a great officer. Yes, sir. I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
What is your date of retirement, and do you have your life story written down somewhere?
Oh, about my life story?
What was the date of your retirement?
You retired in 1960.
Oh, I retired from the Army in 1968, and the day after I retired, I became a chief of police. I didn't shoot anybody for 9 days. That's kind of record for me. 3 weeks later, I shot another guy, and the bad guys knew that they was in serious trouble. The guy before me was afraid of him, but I wasn't afraid of him.
Dad,
mess with me, I'd shoot him.
Dad, was your life story written somewhere? That's the part of the question.
Bob, stand up. Mm-hmm. You can't see you.
I got to tell you something, folks. I'm a Ford observer, and I had a lot of bad stuff landing right on top of me, and I'm kind of hard hearing. So, somebody tell me the question.
Oh, yeah.
Of all the people you've met, who did you cherish the most?
Of the what?
Out of all the people you've met, who did you cherish the most?
Who'd you like the most?
Who'd you like?
Who did I like the most?
Uh-huh.
I bet the best way I can answer that question, anybody wearing a uniform. I was a professional soldier, and I led men in combat, and I know some of you have done it too. And I would tell you the truth. I've been sitting here running my mouth about all this stuff, but I haven't done anything that you people haven't done because of my what my job was. I was always involved in the front of it, and I just got good at it, is the best way to say it. My regimental commander retired as a three-star general, and he, for about 60 years, he made speeches about me, called me the fearless warrior. And not too long ago, some general asked me, he said, "Sergeant Rosser, was you ever afraid during the war?" And I said, "No, sir." He said, "Was you ever afraid in your life?" I said, "Oh, yes, sir." He said, "How about being afraid? What caused you to be afraid?" I said, "I was afraid three different times, sir." And he said, "What caused you to be afraid?" I said, "I had three wives file for alimony."
Yeah! I got it there.
Well, you, okay, that's it.
Once again, I can't tell you how blessed I am to be the president of this organization, because it gives me the opportunity to hang out with guys like this. And you know, I thought I knew a lot. Now I know everything. Mr. Ron Rosser, as the president of the Ernie Pyle chapter, it gives me great honor and pleasure to present to you our World War II challenge coin.
Mm-hmm.
And now...
I like that. That's the first medal I got.
This lovely lady also...
Yes, thank you. So be it known that on this date of September 25th, 2018, the World War II Roundtable hereby recognizes Ronald E. Rosser for his military service in the United States Army during the Korean War. Your military service exemplifies the true spirit of freedom and dedication to the United States. It is with great pleasure that the Roundtable board members and the entire membership recognizes you as an outstanding American and a member of the Roundtable. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to say one thing more. The people wonder why I was like I was in combat. And I'm going to tell you something that's it's hard to believe for you folks. The only value I put on my life was the responsibility of taking care of the men I was responsible for. I didn't even care if I died the next minute, as long as I could take care of them. And that's what I was doing my whole year in the Korean War, trying to take care of the men I was responsible for. And I was honor bound to do it.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Okay, folks, we have a few very special items that we felt it would be more fitting to have a live auction for. Mm-hmm. So one of the first, the country of South Korea, about 12 years ago, did this book.
Sergeant Rosser, I wanted to say thank you very much for telling that very honorable and one of the best stories we've heard for Voices Live On. And congratulations for receiving the Medal of Honor. You have an unbelievable story. Thank you.